There were more women in the global and U.S. workforce in 1995, the year that the world gathered in Beijing for the Fourth World Conference on Women, than there were in January 2020. That's before the pandemic.
Welcome to Global Dispatches, a podcast for the foreign policy and global development communities and anyone who wants a deeper understanding of what is driving events in the world today. I'm your host, Mark Leon Goldberg. I am a veteran international affairs journalist and the editor of UN Dispatch. Enjoy the show. Looking for a trustworthy podcast to bring you unfiltered viewpoints and experiences on global health? Tune into Global Health Matters, the podcast that connects silos and amplifies diverse voices to give you a holistic picture. Each month, Dr. Gary Aslanian from the World Health Organization hosts discussions with guests spanning former ministers of health, award-winning journalists and authors, and frontline public health workers. Join listeners from across 180 countries for an exciting season 4, launching in June. Global Health Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. The Commission on the Status of Women concludes this week at the United Nations. CSW, as it is known, is one of the major annual events at UN headquarters, second only to the opening of the UN General Assembly in September. But unlike UNGA, it rarely gets much media attention, at least not the kind of attention commensurate for a diplomatic gathering of its size. So joining me to explain the key debates and discussions from the 68th Commission on the Status of Women is Michelle Milford Morse, Vice President for Girls and Women Strategy at the United Nations Foundation. We kick off with a long conversation about the unique diplomatic dynamic surrounding international debates and discussions on gender equality, including why, after years of progress, advocates for gender equality are now playing defense. We then discuss some of the items that were on the agenda at CSW this year. I appreciated this conversation very much. It also helps to achieve one of the key goals of this podcast, which is to shine a light and give coverage to events like this that don't get the attention they deserve. One of the core missions of this podcast is to shine a light on undercovered global stories, and the dearth of coverage from the Commission on the Status of Women, I think, demanded that we do an episode on this topic. I learned a lot from this conversation, and I know you will too. Now, here is my conversation with Michelle Milford Morse of the United Nations Foundation. Typically, before an interview like this, my process is that I will read as much as I can about what happened at the event. This event, as far as I can tell, next to zero, at least English language coverage in most media outlets. Why is that?
Well, Mark, I think it's worth reminding listeners who maybe are less familiar with this process that we gather at the United Nations every year in March over 2 weeks for what is called the Commission on the Status of Women. It has a very long history. This is the 68th one. And member states gather and discuss gender equality, girls and women's rights, and they form agreed conclusions over the 2 weeks. And you're right, there's not enough media coverage of this. I think it's not a moment that captures the public imagination about what's possible for girls and women's rights, because I think that it has become a pretty vexed space. The agreed conclusions show progress that is incremental and fragile and small. Right now, I think the negotiations are going well. And certainly, there are a lot of member states that are so completely and totally committed to the promise of gender equality and to serving the interests of half our human family. But it is also true that this all happens in a context where there's a lot of there are a lot of actors who don't think that girls and women deserve full rights. And so maybe progress here sometimes feels perfunctory and small compared to some of the other things that happen in the UN and some of the things that are happening out in the wide world.
I know you are a veteran of many CSWs. And before we get into the substance of what happened at the Commission on the Status of Women this year, I'm interested in just broadly getting a sense for you, like what was the vibe or mood this year compared to that of years past? And based on your answer to my first question, I take it not all that great.
There's an interesting bifurcation of feeling that happens here in New York. On the one hand, you have this incredible, joyful flourishing of solidarity among women and men, people of all kinds and from all places who believe in the promise of equality. And they gather here. I believe that this, and we don't have all the official numbers yet, but we have anecdotal reports that we have the largest number of registrants to this conference ever.
Which is significant because you're talking about significant numbers here.
Significant numbers. And I know the NGO forum was packed. The side events are packed. The sidewalks around here are packed. So that is one element of this. This is considered a really joyful moment in a lot of ways for our movement because we are together. We are reminded that we are not alone. In fact, we are reminded that we are the majority. Most people in the world, fair-minded women and men in all their diversity, want equality and justice for all. And this is one of the places where we gather and express that and defend it. So that is one thing that is wonderful about CSW and what makes it a moment that I look forward to every year. But then there is this other part of it, which is that advocates, activists, they're showing up from all over the world and from places where we're experiencing real pushback against gender equality. And there is pushback in their home countries. There's pushback inside the UN. And so that is the part that makes this a frustrating moment. So there is joy. There's also frustration. There's also impatience. It is called CSW 68. We've been at this for 68 years. One would hope that would mean that every year we push further and further and claim more rightful, equal space at the negotiating table, equal protection under the law, equal roles in economies and societies and politics, but that's not what's happening. And so there is joy, but there's deep impatience.
So I wanted to talk to you about that pushback because it has been the case over the last, you know, at least decade or so, but certainly seems to be accelerating that platforms like the CSW, while they are a moment for NGOs all committed to gender equality and women's rights to convene at the UN, they've also become a gathering place for NGOs and other movements that are opposed to those very rights. You're seeing like growing participation by socially and potentially religiously conservative organizations that seek to halt progress towards broader, you know, goals around gender equality. How did you see that dynamic manifest itself this year? And I take it from your answer to my previous questions that those groups are really present this year, very much so.
They are. I think for the benefit of the listeners too, we should ground this in the context of the wider world first, which is to say, it is true that in a lot of different economies and a lot of different countries, the optics for gender equality can be really reassuring. Women as heads of state, women on high courts, women running companies. But the reality is we're in a decade of stagnation when it comes to the evolution of our rights. There were more women in the global and U.S. workforce in 1995, the year that the world gathered in Beijing for the Fourth World Conference on Women, than there were in January 2020. That's before the pandemic. The World Bank just 2 weeks ago said that girls and women still only have 2/3 of the legal rights that men and boys have. I think in 2022, they told us it was the slowest, smallest year of evolution towards equal protection under the law that they had ever seen in the many years they've been doing their reports. Last summer, UNDP, they do an index of social norms. Their report called it a decade of stagnation. And that sentiment about women as both political leaders and business leaders had barely changed in a decade. And in fact, an astounding percentage of survey respondents hold biased opinions about women as either political leaders or business leaders. So out in the world, there is genuine resistance, stubborn resistance to women's equality. And we see that in progress that is very small and incremental and fragile. The UN is a place where we have to defend that. I think sometimes there's a tendency also to see striving towards gender equality and equal rights as like a Western value. And then we forget that when the UN was founded 77 years ago, it's right there in the charter, the equality of men and women so that we may thrive in larger freedom. It's right there. I think there's a tendency to see this as a Western value and that maybe to use the UN as a forum to make that point and to resist these kind of universal values. The UN's a really important place where we have to resist that, where we have to show up and represent the full flourishing opportunity and potential of half our human family. To be direct, yes, antagonist forces, they are here and they are learning how to use the UN. That's absolutely true.
Is the general dynamic this year and in recent past years one in which advocates for gender equality are finding themselves playing more defense? You know, in decades past, there was a flurry of progress, but now it seems, as you're describing it, we're just trying to like maintain the progress that we've made and really prevent against regression.
That is correct. There's some important dynamics that influence that. First of all, our agenda keeps growing as the world evolves and changes. We have a legacy agenda that includes everything from securing equal pay for equal work to equal educational opportunities to ending gender-based violence, which the best data we have shows affects 1 in 3 women globally. But over time, the women's movement has had to get smart about and be sure it is not left behind on an evolving set of issues, including climate change, STEM, AI, democracy, mental health, you name it. And we have a commitment over time. We've stand shoulder to shoulder with lots of other movements in this larger quest for justice for all. We are doing that at a time when funding for civil society advocacy is shrinking. So a lot of people are doing a lot more with a lot less. We are doing so in a moment where civil society spaces are shrinking in and around the UN. Certainly the UN's liquidity crisis is affecting that.
You're referring to like a cash crunch that is impacting UN operations around the world.
Absolutely. There are shrinking civil society spaces. There are shrinking resources for civil society advocates. There is a growing agenda. Longtime funders in this space are rightfully concerned about climate change and sometimes are switching their funding to climate change programs, even though the overlap between gender equality and climate is profound and important. You're right. We are in a bit of a defensive crouch in some areas when I think actually we need to go boldly on the offensive about what is right and what needs to be done. I will add that no one I know is going to give up. Like, we are not going to cede this space to anti-rights actors. But to say that we are in a new moment where some of these actors emboldened by autocratic tendencies in some countries, by a sense that the women's movement can be defeated. Yeah, that's a real worry for us.
Well, so what were some of the key themes and debates at this year's CSW? And how did the dynamic you just described and we've been discussing really manifest themselves at the UN this year?
Well, I'm happy to say the theme was just maybe among the biggest and most meaningful that we could take on. And that is the feminization of poverty. I mean, it is about poverty itself. And about the degree to which when we talk about poverty, we're talking about girls and women. That is not to say that men and boys don't also suffer economic exclusion and poverty. They do. But a lot of our indicators and a lot of the causes and consequences of poverty especially affect women. So CSW took this on this year, and it led to some truly important conversations about finance. So that means, what does it mean if the International Finance financial institutions, the development banks, the way that governments budget and spend money? What would it mean if reform of those institutions, if a new set of norms and priorities at those institutions started to focus on what is happening with girls and women? And it has led to, I think, in the past 2 weeks, some bold and honest conversations. I'm finally hearing around the events and the meetings here a focus on things like taxation, the debt repayment by African governments, illicit flows. All of those things are being brought into this conversation because they are denying governments in some cases, and in some cases, constraining international financial institutions from investing in women. And so the women's movement, a lot of leaders that I deeply admire and a lot of big thinkers on this are tackling some of those big issues that affect a lot of development conversations and pointing those discussions towards gender equality and girls and women's rights. That has been invigorating, by the way, and I think eye-opening for a lot of people here. The other thing that's been very invigorating is a renewed and determined focus on care and the care economy. The care economy has been getting a lot of traction in this CSW, and that makes sense. The underpaid care work that girls and women provide to children, to elderly, to neighbors, to communities that women do, it is a massive wealth transfer to governments. It's basically a subsidy, and to the great harm of a lot of girls and women. What I mean by that is that if girls and women are doing three times as much care work as the men and boys in their lives and in their families, it means that they can't pursue other educational opportunities. It means that they can't pursue other job opportunities. It means they can't pursue entrepreneurial opportunities. It means that they can't potentially run for office. It means that they can't enjoy their right to leisure like everybody else. So this conversation about that has gotten, I think, more serious and more intentional and more nuanced too, because there are people who will say, well, don't women love taking care of their children? And the answer is yes, many of them do. That's not what we're talking about. We are talking about the degree to which societies rely almost wholly and involuntarily on girls and women to take care of society. And by that, I mean children, and again, neighbors, elderly, everybody. And care is sacred. You need care. I need care. We need to be really serious about what it would mean to build caring societies. And we need to be serious about what a lack of a caring society means for women in poverty. That part has been invigorating too.
So we're speaking near the very tail end of the two-week conference. And earlier you said that negotiations were underway. What exactly is being negotiated?
So for your listeners who are not familiar with this, I mean, just across the street is the UN building. There are rooms over there where every government has sent a negotiator. They are reading line by line, paragraph by paragraph, a zero draft of agreed conclusions. A zero draft just says, we agree to these things. They acknowledge past themes of CSW. They acknowledge the current theme of CSW. And governments will go line by line, paragraph by paragraph, until they get to some agreed conclusions, which generally are finalized by Friday. That's this Friday. And then put into the record for the CSW. And this CSW will close. So that's happening now. And it's painstaking work. It can be really difficult work. There are years that we haven't gotten agreed conclusions. We did last year. I think everyone expects that we'll get agreed conclusions this year, but that's what's happening just next door right now.
And is there any like specific language that you as an observer and an advocate are hoping is included in this zero draft?
Definitely. I mean, I think a lot of us have had to temper our ambitions over the years about what the agreed conclusions will say. I think we always, frankly, we always want more. But the zero draft of the agreed conclusions had a paragraph about women, peace, and security. What an important time for us to focus on women, peace, and security. I was happy to see that. I hope that the language on women, peace, and security remains there. And I think anyone who cares about the lack of real investment in gender equality hopes that there is some serious language in there about the need to invest in women in all regions, across sectors and issues, that there's going to take some serious thinking about the reform of our financial institutions, how things get invested in to make sure that happens. I don't want to presuppose what they're going to say. I'm not in the room, of course, but it is past time to take seriously the lack of investment in girls and women and the need for us to get serious about doing it better and doing it now.
And these questions about like language that gets included in outcome documents at the UN, in my experience, can be very in the weeds, like very quickly. But the reason I asked you about it kind of goes back to the earlier part of our conversation where we were talking about how advocates for rights are kind of playing defense these days. And it's often kind of measured in what language is included. Like, is the word sexual included before sexual and reproductive health? Is the word reproductive health even included? Like, those kinds of really kind of in the weeds decisions are how one measures progress often in these kinds of UN forums.
Correct. There's a line, and we're always trying to hold the line. And we're trying to hold the line on bodily autonomy. We're trying to hold the line on comprehensive sexuality education. We're trying to hold the line on those things. And some years, it's just harder than others. And people are in the rooms negotiating until late into the night to hold the line on those things. Because this year has a different theme, some of the types of conversations here have been different, no less controversial and no less important, but have been a little bit different. But I think your point about being on defense is not incorrect. Again, if we've been doing this for 68 years, one would hope, one would want for there to be absolutely no question that women deserve a full and equal right to participation in politics and in economies and in societies. That's not what we're discussing all the time. We're discussing some pretty small and incremental things.
Lastly, you know, is there any sort of question I didn't ask or point you wanted to make?
I've been impressed this time around by the optimistic impatience. So it is both impatient, but it is also an impatience that doesn't suggest that we're all going to give up. But I've been impressed by it. The advocates who show up here to fight for girls and women's rights are just the toughest, boldest, bravest that exist. And they do it under pretty difficult circumstances. And I take a lot of inspiration from that. And I learn every time there's a CSW. I try to make time to really listen because it's how I really learn. So I wouldn't want the listener to think that even though we're not going to get agreed conclusions that have everything that we want, there's a lot of people here committed to it over the long term and committed to supporting each other and doing it in solidarity. That for me remains one of the most valuable aspects of this. I think also what feels true right now is you and your listeners will certainly have heard of the permacrisis. The permacrisis does feel real when you're here. It is true that a keen observer will see the overlaps between gender equality, life on a habitable planet, a rising number of humanitarian crises and conflict. We see the overlap in all of those things. And we see a need to get very serious and very focused on all of them. I mean, Mark, as soon as CSW is over, member states will return to their negotiating on the summit of the future. And soon on the near horizon, we'll have the HLPF to keep the SDGs on track.
That's the high-level political forum for not knowing all the UN acronyms. I'm rarely stumped, so please go ahead.
The high-level political forum, correct. That will take place in July, and that is just on the near horizon. So these very serious questions about how to keep our global goals on track, how to make sure the UN is fit for purpose and fit for the future, these are really serious discussions. CSW is one of the discussions that feeds into that in this larger reckoning that we're all dealing with about life on this planet right now and our responsibility to it and to the people who live on this planet. And so I'm energized by the past 2 weeks, but I don't think any of us are going to take our eye off the ball after these 2 weeks ends.
Michelle, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for listening to Global Dispatches. The show is produced by me, Mark Leon Goldberg. It is edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to follow the show and enable automatic downloads to get new episodes as soon as they're released. On Spotify, tap the bell icon to get a notification when we publish new episodes. And of course, please visit globaldispatches.org to get on our free mailing list, get in touch with me, and access our full archive. Thank you.